Exception number 8736, rule number 17.
Lord Harding, tape 17. Yes, you were explaining about Rommel and how really you didn't know the man by his reputation at that particular stage. When he started to advance, were you surprised at the speed? You know, did it seem quite quick? I suppose relative to the Italians as well.
Oh, yes, compared to the Italians, of course. But yes, it did. I was surprised at the speed with which they were able to launch forth from Tripoli into a full-scale offensive against us, first of all in our position at Ejid Abia, and then continuing that advance right across the desert and driving us back as they did to Gazala. In one movement, both the speed of their advance, the opportunist tactics that were employed, the effectiveness and efficiency of the German armor, in particular, their reconnaissance and their battle groups. Yes, and we were ill prepared for any of that, either mentally or physically. And the result was they were eminently successful, and they drove us back, first of all, to Tobruk. And it was on the way back to in the withdrawal to Tobruk that I lost my two generals. Both O'Connor and Neim were captured. And I found myself without a general. Got back to to Mimi, and with one staff officer, and started to try and get control. Then it was clear that there was no possibility of holding up the German advance, except at Tobruk. So I went back into Tobruk. Well, I found General Morshead, the 9th Australian, commanding the 9th Australian Division, and between us, we organized the defense of Tobruk. And it was at that stage, while that was going on, that Wavell came up to Tobruk, flew up into Tobruk. And the story is, really, I was very busy. I got a message from GHQ to say that I'd set up a headquarters in Tobruk because that was the only place where there were any effective communications. It would have been badly knocked about, but there were some communications there, and so we set up a headquarters there. And I got a message to say that the Commander-in-Chief was coming up to see for himself. I was very busy. I really had two queues. People at that time, representatives and commanders of units that had been driven back and in retreat on one queue, and commanders or representatives of units coming up in as reinforcements from the desert on the other. And I took them off, took one off ahead of each queue in turn, trying to sort out the mess. And the 9th Australian Division were very, very, very good. I mean, they had taken up defensive positions. We had some artillery, we had some anti-aircraft artillery, we had some tanks. Not very many, but we had some. And so there, Leslie Morshead and his staff were very busy organizing the defense of Tobruk. And I got this message about the Commander-in-Chief coming up, and then there was a dust storm. Tobruk is very susceptible to dust storms. And the RAF said no, of course it was impossible, they wouldn't land. However, while I was very busy, in walked the Commander-in-Chief with two or three staff officers, including General Lavarack, an Australian general, And Freddie de Gangon, who was later chief of staff to Monty, and Charles Gardner, who was at that time had been on the staff, had been G1 of 7th Armored Division. They were chaps that I didn't know Freddie de Gangon, but I knew Charles Gardner very well. I hadn't met the Australian general before. Well, I had arranged, I had set up a blackboard and maps on the first floor of the Municipio, where my headquarters was in Tobruk, in preparation for giving the Commander-in-Chief a presentation if he arrived. But then, to my surprise, he did arrive with these people. They took him upstairs, and I told him, gave him my assessment of the situation. So all he said was, well, if you think you can hold it, you better hold it. And what do you think? I said, well, sir, I think we can hold it, provided the Navy are able to maintain supplies, and the Germans, rubble, doesn't wheel up a mass of heavy tanks and attack it with. So then he said, well, if you think you can hold it, you better hold it. And with that, he said, well, I must get back to my headquarters, and I'm leaving General Laverack here, the Australian general, to take command. Give me a millboard. You know, in those days, everybody, the staff carried a millboard with some foolscap on it. And with his own hand, he wrote out a directive to General Laverack to hold Tobruk. On one side, his big round writing, on one side of a sheet of foolscap. Then he handed it to me and said, is that all right? And I read it and said, oh, yes, of course. So as I tell you, he always gave me the most wonderful confidence, aren't you, Ravel? And he said, well, show it to General Laverack. And I showed it to General Laverack. And then he said, well, it's him. Is it all right? And Laverack, I don't think he dared say it wasn't. Said, oh, yes, of course, sir. So our Archie Ravel said, all right, John, send a copy to my headquarters. And off you went. Well, I went back. I talked to General Laverack, and I made arrangements about how we were going to continue to work together. And I went back to what I was doing. And I don't know what time it was. It may have been midnight or thereabouts. The telephone rang from Cairo. One of the few times I'd spoken to Cairo from Tobruk on the telephone. And somebody, a staff officer at the other end, said, where is the Commander-in-Chief? So I said, well, he left here, so-and-so, on his way back. But they said, well, he hadn't arrived. I said, well, it's dark now. I don't know what to do. I'll send out search parties in the morning, but I don't know what else to do. And he said, all right. Well, then about an hour later, the telephone rang again. It was the Commander-in-Chief on the telephone. I said, oh, my goodness, where are you, sir? He said, I've force landed near Saloum. Send a Lizzie for me, Lysander, that one. Send a Lizzie for me in the morning, will you, John? And he sounded completely unperturbed. So I said, oh, yes, of course, sir. And that was that. We sent off Lizzie in the morning, picked him up, and there was I. And then I was left with General Laverack, who'd taken over command, General Morset, commanding the 9th Australian Division, and all the bits and pieces that we had there, and we set to work to make a detailed plan for the defence of Tobruk.
How easy a place was it to defend Tobruk?
Well, it wasn't an easy place to defend. The Italian defences were still there. There was an anti-tank ditch. There was wire, and there were some trenches. But our plan then was get the Australian infantry dug in defensive posts, covering the perimeter of the fortress, as I call it, and to have an arrangement whereby every gun, whether it was a field gun, a medium gun, or an anti-tank gun, warned to ready itself for anti-tank action on receipt of a code word. And Donald Walters and I arranged the code word, which was on guard 10, 12, 20, 45, according to the number of tanks that were intended, that were reported to have broken into the defences. And Rommel attacked. His infantry made a hole in the forward defences. The Australian infantry stood their ground wonderfully. And the German tanks broke in. And then they started milling round, and of course they got shot at everywhere they went, and they lost quite a number of tanks, and eventually they pulled out. But if the Germans had been able to support them with more infantry and artillery, we would probably have lost the place. But as it was, mainly I think due to the fact that every single gun within the perimeter was ready for anti-tank work, and also, and probably most importantly of all, that the Australian infantry stood their ground and held their positions, the attack was defeated.
What role did the Royal Navy play in that? Were they
helpful? I don't know. We relied on them for supplies, of course, but I don't think. I don't know. There were no armor. There were no. Battleships or cruisers or destroyers or anything. I don't think there was any question of any naval gunfire. I don't remember it, but I don't think there was. No, we depended on them entirely for supplies. And of course they lost an awful lot of ships supplying Tobruk as time went on.
How about the inhabitants of Tobruk? Did you have any problems there?
No, there weren't any. I don't remember there being any.
They had vacated the city.
They disappeared. I don't remember any problem. Certainly, I think they mostly disappeared. It wasn't a very big place, you know. And, of course, all the Italians had disappeared. And such Arabs as there were there, I think they'd vamoosed too. I don't remember any problem to do with civilians. I don't remember ever seeing any about the place.
Did you have an evacuation plan worked out for evacuation?
No.
You didn't foresee?
No, we were determined to hold it. We've been told to hold it, so we're going to hold it.
When Rommel was sweeping forward, this is going back a bit, when you vacated, say, Benghazi, did you have time to do anything about destruction of stores in that area?
No, we didn't. I think we lost an awful lot of stuff. We hadn't got an awful lot of stuff on the ground, but we did lose what we had on the ground. I think there may have been, there probably were ammunition dumps in the middle of the desert, like places like Mekelle. I don't suppose there was an awful lot in Benghazi, but there must have been some. And in the backup to Benghazi, but there wasn't an awful lot. But what was there, we lost, and we did lose quite a lot of stuff, of course, one way or another. But it wasn't anything like a massive loss, because we hadn't got it.
How about casualties? You know, in terms of troops at this stage.
I don't really remember what the figures were. I don't think they were particularly heavy. There were casualties, of course. But I don't remember what the figures were, but I don't think they were severe.
Could I ask you a little more about O'Connor being taken prisoner? Because after all, you worked very closely together with him at that stage. Why weren't you with him when he was taken? Were you doing a completely different task?
We were in different places. What happened was, we were together at Barchi, and which was the headquarters, the fourth headquarters, and the Australians were in front of us, and they started to withdraw. whoever decided, Neame and O'Connor between them, decided that we must withdraw the headquarters too. It was obvious we had to. And the intention was to withdraw the headquarters back to the Mimi to start with, which is at the base of the triangle, as I call it, the bulge, and then probably into the brook. And so Dick O'Connor and Philip Neame, together with John Coombe and Dan Ranfley, who was Philip Neame's ADT, went off together in a car to go back to Mimi and probably to Brooke. And they left. I had a number of signals to clear, things that I was doing, and I reckoned I must see them settled and dealt with out to the various people and that sort of thing before I left. So I left with Owen Nares in another car about an hour later. Well, we started along the road, along the top of the Jebel, and then the Australian columns were blocking the road, and also, it was mainly because the Australian, the road was very very fully blocked by the Australian withdrawal. So instead of going back along the top road, I decided to go down into Derna. And we went down into Derna and then back to Tamimi along the coast. And on the way, we were fired at by a German patrol, I suppose, fighting patrol or armored group. But we managed to get through, and we got through to Tamimi, where we found a chap called, what was his name? Terribly good chap, who was later chief engineer of its army. Oh, I can't remember your name now. And there was a small group of our people there, and the Germans were attacking them. There was a German reconnaissance group that had come down towards the road, towards the coast at Tamimi. So we stopped there, and this chap, I wish I could remember his name, organized a defense there, and we drove out of the German patrol and withdrew. And so I was able to start work on my signals and communications there. And I was later a great Zionist. Can't remember it anyway, don't know. So we stopped at Tamimi and set up I merely had a wireless set, I think. Peter Marsham and I, he went fast asleep, had a wireless set there, and we tried to keep in touch with the Australians and the armored group in Mekelle. And I can't remember. I think we stayed there. We remained there that night, trying to establish communications. And it was then that I got a report that my two generals didn't appear. And so I didn't know what had happened to them. And there was no information about what had happened to them. So I thought, well, I'm going to send out reconnaissance parties and try and find out what's happened to them in the morning. Well, come the morning, we got a report from the air, from our air cooperation squadron, one of the aircraft, found a group of British troops, obviously taken prisoner, up near Martuba, which was on the top of the Jebel, where there was an airfield. And it seemed clear that probably O'Connor and Neame were with that lot. And so I sent out armored car patrols, but they were unable to break through the German covering force. And so that was that. So then I decided that the only thing to do was to move back into the Brook and try and establish a headquarters there, in conjunction with the 9th Australian Division, which I did. It was a pretty hairy time. After beating off Rommel's first attack, we got orders that the 9th Australian Division would stay and continue to hold Tobruk, And at the Western Desert Force headquarters, what remained of it, the sort of nucleus of it, which was I was with, was to come back and join up with the rear part of the headquarters in Mersema II. Was it Mersema II? No, it was further back. Can't remember where. In Bagoosh, yeah, Martin Bagoosh. That's right. Well, there was a headquarters there. So we were drawn by sea. We went out by sea from Tobruk. Well, I and well, I suppose I had two or three staff officers and a few clerks, but we hadn't got any. We lost our vehicles, of course, then, and we were withdrawn in a frigate or whatever it was. And went back to Martin Bagoosh, where I joined up with. I left. Larek was remained in Tobruk in command, and I joined up with Beresford Fierce, which was then established at Mersema II as the headquarters Western Desert Force, and we set up a full headquarters there with the proper staff and everything. Established communications with Tobruk and with who's covering the front then? Can't remember what other troops we had. We had other troops anyway. No, I can't remember.
Not.
Well, by that time, of course, the Germans, Rommel's forces, had... wait a minute. No, we fought a battle. We did halt at Gazala, didn't we? And then we're driven back from there. I'm a very hazy about that period, but I think we did... Or that may have been late. That was later. That was in the subsequent campaign. Anyway, the Germans were in occupation of Hellfire. It was Saloum, Hellfire, El Adam, and forward from there up to the Omars and so on. We were told from GHQ that we were getting. There was a 7th Armored Brigade, commanded by Hugh Russell, which was our main principal armored force. I think it was mainly the 7th Armored Division, really. But the 7th Armored Brigade was the Armored Brigade. And we were told that we were getting a lot of new tanks and the Commander-in-Chief's intention to launch an offensive, to drive Rommel back from Tobruk, where he was encircling Tobruk at that time, and Tobruk was cut off completely. So the Commander-in-Chief's plan was to launch an offensive against Rommel's force with all these new tanks that were coming up. And Beresford Pierce had the planning of that. I, for the life of me, can't remember the detail of the planning, but the main plan, I think, was to attack the Germans with 7th Armored Brigade and with its new tanks. But there was a lot of delay in getting the new tanks desert worthy, and also in training the troops in their use. And the whole thing, looking back on it, to my mind, was very rushed. And also, the intelligence, the GHQ intelligence assessment of the German armored strength was very wrong. But looking back on it, I'm quite sure it was, they were far too optimistic in their assessment of the German armored strength. Well, in any case, what happened was the offensive was launched. To start off with, it started off with some success and then petered out. And obviously, it was a tremendous disappointment, particularly to the commander-in-chief. And I remember his coming up to our headquarters, and that was the only time I've ever seen Archie Wavell in tears. And he was bitterly disappointed. He had put tremendous faith in the success of this operation to drive Rommel back west of Tobruk, and to probably then to build up to resume a full-scale offensive. But it failed. And it failed primarily because they were outgunned by the German army. And at that time, I think it was then, that was the first time the Germans had introduced the 88 as an anti-tank weapon. And that, of course, was decisive against our tanks.
Was it a very good weapon, the
88? Well, it was an anti-aircraft gun, really. And they used it in an anti-tank role, and it was particularly effective. And then, from then on, it played a predominant part in the armored fighting in the Western Desert. And we had nothing to compare with it. And our own tanks were undergunned and under-armored. I mean, the Crusader tank, which again I fought with at Delamain, that was a very fairer tank to the German Mark III and the German Mark IV. And also, whether they'd learnt it from their experience on the Western Desert or whether they had learnt it from study and so on, or both, they handled armour with their infantry and artillery in a very efficient way, and we had a lot to learn.
And was that consistently so up until the time you left the Western Desert?
Well, that was up to the time of Delamain.
Yes, they were superior, you felt, in technology.
Well, up to the battle of Delamain and the pursuit for Delamain, yes, I would say that they had the better of us in both equipment and tactics and leadership until Monty took over.
Yes, we must come to that soon.